So I've got all my little things set up here, and I guess I'm ready to go. Tonight I want to talk about these principles of Hiri and Otapa. And some of you may have never heard of Hiri and Otapa, but the Buddha called them bright guardians of the world. And they are not the easiest thing to talk about because why? They involve dukkha. But they are a lifesaver in this practice and the world. So it seems so appropriate to talk about this as we're coming into this last week. And all the talks we have had leading up to this last week, especially the last week of talks, have been leading up to this place where we can actually talk about Hiri and Otapa and maybe get a little understanding around them. But I want to step back here for a moment because we haven't had a direct talk on emptiness, even though we've been pointing to it along the way. You can't really talk about Hiri and Otapa unless you're coming into a framing based on emptiness, based on a sense that this is not about you, and it's not about who you are, and it's not about this sense of identity. I mean, Hiri and Otapa is way out beyond that. So I want to start with this sutta where Buddha, it's between Buddha and his son, Rahula. Rahula was 18. And so they were going on alms rounds. And as they were going, the Buddha looked back and said something to Rahula. He says, Rahula, any form whatsoever that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near, every form is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment as this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. And so Rahula said, just form? And the Buddha replied, form, Rahula, and feeling tones, and perception, and fabrications or mental formations and consciousness. And the sutta goes on to say that Venerable Rahula felt as if the Buddha had scolded him. He felt this kind of reproach from the Buddha. And so he did not believe he could continue in the alms rounds. And so he turned back and went and started meditating. And a senior monk saw him sitting there and went over and gave him the instructions on mindfulness of breathing. And so later in the afternoon, Rahula goes to the Buddha and he says, you know, how is mindfulness of breathing to be developed and pursued so as to be of great fruit or great benefit? I take that to mean Buddha, Rahula was saying, what is this mindfulness? What's the point of doing this meditation? I think he was a little agitated in the mind and he was having some problems trying to do this whole mindfulness of breathing. And so the Buddha tells him in relationship to what he had said earlier that he is to develop a mind that sees and discerns, this is not mine. This is not myself and this is not what I am. And he further says to do that, he needs to develop a mind in tune with the elements. And he goes into a discussion about the fact that the earth, water, air, wind, fire, space, all can have things thrown at them, put upon them, mistreated, and yet they don't take it all in as in this personal way. And so the Buddha, to me, was trying to teach Rahula how to be empty of a egoic sense around what happens. And when I first read this sutta, I mean, like so many suttas, sometimes when you first read them, it sounds impossible. It is impossible to me that the idea, so you got to know, I mean, I was already very arrogant and very connected to me, very much me. I knew who I was and I knew I was great. I mean, I was a lawyer, prosecutor. That was the best. I could control anything and everything. And so to read this sutta where he says, what he actually said was, just as when people throw what is clean or unclean on the earth, wind, water, fire, and space, the element is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted by it. In the same way, when you are developing the meditation in tune with the earth, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions that have arisen will not stay in charge of your mind. What I heard in that was that people could do all kinds of things to me, any old thing to me, and I would not be horrified, humiliated, or disgusted by it. That is what I heard. And the idea that this was the way practice was supposed to go did not resonate with me at all. It did not make any sense to me at all. And I thought I was just going to become a doormat. And I couldn't really, I just couldn't grasp it. What the Buddha went on to say, that if you could see both the internal and the external property elements, the elements, elemental properties, and that you could actually begin to see them with right discernment, that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself, then one would thus see it as it actually is, and the mind would become disenchanted with the elemental property, and it would make even the elemental property fade away. So what the Buddha was actually telling Rahula, what I think, I've read this sutta so many times, just over the years, because I have such a love and respect for Buddha. Even if I think something is stupid and not right, I'm going to keep reading it so I can begin to understand what I'm missing. There's got to be a missing here. I've read so many suttas that I didn't agree with originally that I have come to understand how Buddha talks in ways that don't sound like us. He is not talking like we talk to each other. He knew Rahula. In fact, one of my teachers said she believes that Rahula was kind of walking behind the Buddha, like, that's my dad, look at me, that's my dad. That kind of energy, this kind of prideful energy. And that's why the Buddha said something. And it's why Rahula had this sense that he had been reproached by the Buddha and then turned back. So this kind of feeling, then he turns back and you can see how he's now spinning in his own world, doing this mindfulness, trying to be mindful, and the Buddha's interjection, this interrupts this flow by trying to help him learn how to be empty, not a doormat, but how to be empty, meaning that he could actually have the capacity to shift his own mind out of the mental torment of that anger. So this idea that people can just dump on us is what the ordinary mind would think. And what Buddha was pointing him to is, how can you let go of whatever that mental spinning you're in because you think I reproached you or somehow scolded you when I really did not? I just corrected your view. And in that, you can let go of all that personalizing energy that's come up on him. As I begin to read this, I begin to see that everything about my disruptions in life, everything about dukkha, everything about the difficulties I was having in life, it's really hard to say this, but it's all coming from me. The first time I realized this, my teacher, Rodney, one night, Seattle Insight, said, take one thing and soften around it and work with that one thing. Soften around it for the whole week. And I decided that I was going to come into my meetings with defense attorneys soft, like just going to be soft. And I'm going to wait 10 minutes, let them say whatever they need to say, and then I would tell them no. So there would be like this... I'm going to be soft. I'm going to wait with this kinder state. And then I could say no. So what happened, though, is that 10 minutes, I mean, I could begin to see how I must have been to them before that, right? Because they would come in, they'd start talking, and they'd say, are you going to say anything? And I'm like, no, I'm working on being a kinder government. It would be like, oh, my God. So I just have the floor? And I'm like, yes, you have the floor. And I actually heard things that I would have ignored before. I would have blew it off because I already had my mind made up. And I wouldn't even have listened to that. And I could hear things I otherwise would have had a lot of negativity. It would have been an argument because I would have had my own position and it would have been a push, 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 push. And instead, I would take in what they were saying. And sometimes I shifted and sometimes I didn't, but it was never this automatic no. And I went back to Sims the next week and I was talking to Rodney saying, this feels an awful lot like I'm the one that's wrong. Like I'm the one, like if you just calm Terry down, everything's going to be okay. I said, I cannot live this way. I cannot live my whole life assuming I'm always the wrong one. That something's wrong about this. And Rodney helped me. He's the one that pointed me towards the sutta to begin to read and begin to consider. And gradually over time, I began to realize it wasn't that I was wrong. I just wasn't fighting. It's not a right wrong. It was just that I was open and available, present enough that I could actually have a conversation with this other side rather than it all being a fight the minute they walk in the door and I've already decided. So this kind of opening is a different way of moving in the world. And it wasn't that I had to agree with everything they said. It was just that I had to be open. In fact, what I would say, I had to be empty of all these opinions and judgments and conclusions, and then listen and see. And from that listening and seeing, then anything's possible. So this idea that we are emptying ourselves, turning into marshmallows and nobody, is not so much what emptiness means. It means that we are sensitizing ourselves to the present moment in a completely different way. And this is where I think Kiri and Otapa come into play. So you have to kind of brace yourself for this if you haven't really heard about Kiri and Otapa, and keep in mind that we are not talking about ordinary mind. So Kiri, there are these two poles we move through the world with. Kiri is kind of this internal pole. It's this innate sense of shame around our moral or ethical transgressions. So when we do something, it's tied to the precepts. It's tied to our sense of the precepts. And the precepts are not some edict that somebody handed down and say, this is the way you need to be. They are training, like training wheels, training guidelines on how to be. So when we take the precepts, we don't say, I vow to not harm anybody. We are undertaking the training to refrain from harming someone, which means that there is the possibility that we are going to harm. There is the possibility that we are going to have harsh speech, or there is the possibility that we will abuse intoxicants, even if it's not drinking or using drugs. Could be watching TV too much, watching, eating too much. There's all kinds of ways that we overconsume and get trapped in these addictive behaviors. So we are undertaking the training to watch our speech and watch our sexual energies, things like that. And in that, when we undertake that training, we have to learn when we've violated it. It's a training, right? So we're kind of like going through our, walking around doing our thing. Somehow we have to learn how to know when we have violated this internal code of ethics that we take up individually. Each of us take it up as you will. I remember when I, several years ago, I took these lifetime vows with Bhante Buddhorakhita. And when I took these vows, I was like a little trapped in this kind of world, because I took them on the month March, I mean the March month long, when the pandemic hit. And one of the vows I said, I'm not going to be getting into entertainment, and I'm not going to do all that. And then I leave and get on the plane, and I remember sitting there saying, what have I done? I'm like going into a world where I'm nothing but TV. This is it. Oh, my God. So I send this email to Bhante. I'm like, oh, my God, Bhante, can we have a do-over? And Bhante, we had this video meeting. It's like, you know, Tori, you have to watch into whether or not you are using television to avoid doing responsibilities. This is, you're not monastic, so you're watching into how you are using your entertainment and what you are doing with it. So this is, you know, you can just lay there and watch TV for hours and hours and hours, but you need to know what it is that you're doing with this. And somehow I think we feel into these training vows and we move into them, and gradually we begin to feel when we are within that vow and when we are moving outside of it, right? So this, it's a, you need a degree of sensitivity that we all kind of have here. And it tells you, you know, when you're outside the vow, when you know you're outside the promise. And that's, this is what we're moving towards. Ajahn Suchito calls this ethical sensitivity. It's what the practice creates. This ethical sensitivity, and you begin to know. It's a painful knowing, though. That word shame is not shame as in unworthiness shame. It is shame as in self-respect, your own self-respect and dignity as to how you want to be. Nobody's standing there pointing the finger at you. You're kind of seeing it for yourself. And in that, you are learning where the line is on those boundaries, where the line is on how you want to be. If we did not have Hiri, we'd have a problem. Otapa is on the other side of the magnet, or other side of the pole. It's this external warning system where you begin to sense in, and it's called moral dread of doing the wrong thing. And this kind of moral dread is more tied to this realization of the karmic impact of our actions. It's not a moral dread like society says, don't do this or don't do that. But I begin to learn more and more and more about the karmic impact of my careless anger, careless habits. I begin to see more about the impact it would have on me, my future practice, the impact it would have on the people around me. And I am not going to just be this kind of careless, unthinking person that can cause all this harm. Not because somebody's telling me not to do it. It's because I have a sense that there is a line here that I don't want to cross. There is a line here in the sand that speaks more to me. That line speaks more to me than anything in the outer world can speak to. So this otapa, it's a moral dread, not because the world says it's a dread, but because you know the karmic impact of our behavior. No more do we walk around acting like we can be any way we want and we're not going to have to pay for the impact of our actions. Not even the I do something intentional. Most of us are rarely doing intentional harm. We're even responsible for our unintended harm that has an impact. And this is a big, it's the impact. It's a question. Are we responsible for intention in that we only, if we say we didn't intend it, then I don't have any kind of responsibility for it. But for me, I have begun to see that I would always say I didn't intend harm. I mean, that just rolled off the mouth whenever anybody said, oh, that was a harm. I'm like, my bad. I didn't intend that. I didn't intend that. I didn't mean that. I never meant to harm anybody, which is true. We don't mean to harm people. But as you begin to see the impact of careless, habitual behavior that moves out of habit, then can you really say it's not intended? It's almost like we don't want to see our intentions because they're wrapped in this kind of greed, hatred, and delusion. This is a way the Buddha explained that kind of behavior. In a sutta, he says, practitioners, ignorance precedes the arrival of unskillful qualities, i.e. lack of shame and lack of compunction, which is lack of hiri, lack of otapa. Lack of shame, lack of compunction follow after. Clear knowing precedes the arrival of skillful qualities. Shame and compunction follow after. So what he's saying is that this kind of way that we brush away unintended harm, like, I didn't mean that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. That is the impact of it. We kind of brush it away. But a lot of that unintended harm arises out of ignorance, around our carelessness, around our habits, and not even paying attention to our habit way that we act. We just snap at somebody. We, you know, give someone the side look. That's why I was telling you about that moment when I left the train, because it's not like I would have said I meant to harm her, but in that side glance, careless way of being, harm happens from me. It didn't come randomly, it came from me, because in that moment, I had a lot of ill will and aversion, and not paying attention to that ill will is going to cause, it's just going to flow right out with this harm. But if you're like me, it's not like I could just say, okay, I'm there. I'm not going to be angry anymore. I'm going to calm it all down and be nice. That's that fake way that we try to be nice. We need something that can help us see in the darkness how to line up with this practice that we hold so dear to the heart. And that's where hiri and otapa come into play, because we begin to feel this internal unethical behavior that's against the precepts, even if no one else sees it. We begin to feel this external worry about our karmic behavior when we notice how we're getting all habitual. And in this kind of an environment, we have this kind of container that helps us cultivate a level of sensitivity that we can even see it. And many of you have seen just how painful that habit behavior is. It is painful. It is not a little painful. It is a lot painful. But we never see that level of pain when we're walking about in our ordinary lives. We don't see how painful it is. We kind of recognize a little bit of that, but we still like go along with it and not really get caught in it. So this hiri and otapa are there to cultivate this level of seeing when we don't see. We begin to feel the pain of that. Of our behavior. And it's in that that we begin to train ourselves. So how I think they train us is, one, they have a way of fine-tuning our sense of control. A lot of my tension, a lot of my fear, or just the overreactivity that came from me, came from a sense of needing to control my environment. Not control out of meanness, but control out of a sense that I am not going to be safe and protected if I didn't control my environment. So if I just controlled everything, then there would be a sense of safety. So my safety, or my sense of safety and my sense of, stillness, stability, the world as right as rain, came from this external control that I would put my life in. And I know this is very common. We create control in the outer world thinking, okay, I'm going to stay within the container. Now, precepts are right. Everything is right. Feeling good. Okay, sense it. The problem with this using our external control is the mind that's making that happen is only basing its control on what it likes, what is pleasant, what is pleasable, what it's going to do that it thinks is the right way to do it. And it doesn't challenge its beliefs or assumptions or ideas at all. So everything we do, when I pushed against the people around me and the systems around me, I thought I was right because this is the way we should be. And we get stuck in this box, staying in this world where what feels right, what feels pleasing, what feels orderly becomes what we think is the way to be. And Hiri and Otapa disrupts that all over the place. So whenever I would feel this sense of tension around anything, I would ask myself, okay, Tori, what you trying to control here? I could look for it. I remember one time when I was in therapy, I mentioned to my therapist that I was a slob. She said something, I don't even know why. I go, oh, I'm a slob. She goes, you don't seem like a slob to me. I'm like, oh, you should see my bedroom. It's the worst. Just clothes thrown everywhere. I just throw it everywhere. And she goes, is your whole house like that? And I'm like, oh, no. Oh, the rest of the house is very clean, very orderly. Everything's in the proper place. And the boys used to have to wash their dishes as soon as they got through eating out of it. They had to go wash the plate. No, nothing. And she goes, why do you think the room is so messed up? I'm like, because I'm a slob. Everybody says that. I said, no. She goes, I think there's something else going on. So the more we talked about it, the more we realized my house was very dysfunctional growing up, full of trauma and drama. And the only thing I had that was mine was where I put my clothes. So my father was a military person. You had to hang your clothes up. You had to have them in a certain way, and everything had to be tight. So the house basically would look like it's all orderly, even though it's all crazy. And so I would not do that. I would stuff my clothes under the beds. I would stuff them in between the mattresses. I would stuff them in the closet. I would stuff them everywhere, and I would get in trouble because my father would check everything like a military officer would check. And I'm always getting in trouble. So even as I got older, still sloppy, sloppy, sloppy. Then my therapist made this turn in my understanding that completely changed all that. She goes, I think that messy bedroom is that teenager who would not abide by your parents. I think that's the courageous energy in you that's saying something's not quite right here. And I'm not cleaning up nothing until you get things straight. And that's where it shows up. That's what Hiri and Otapa do. So every time my room would get messy, I would say, "What? Where am I off out of sync, not lined up, not living my truth the way I really want to live my truth? Where am I pretending like everything is orderly, but really something is amiss?" And as soon as I would find that kind of disjointed place, I'd clean my room up. Just clean it up. Just all of a sudden, I have all this energy. Saturday morning, rearrange everything, clean everything up. Because that part of me was lined up. So it's Hiri and Otapa operate like that. When we begin to sense into tension, difficulty, not as a sign that something's wrong, which is the way the world says, but as a sign that, oh, you may be trying to control something that you don't need to control. You may be trying to control other people, your whole situation, and maybe this is not something you can control. And so instead, you learn to rest inward. That's what every single one of you learned on this month long. That's what you learned on a month long better than any other thing. You all learned to kind of back off of this controlling your practice. You may have thought you could control it when you came in, but yeah, at this point, a week to go, ain't no more control up in here. We're all kind of like, oh yeah, I see, don't have control. And so this kind of flowing happens, and yet you feel stronger and stronger in the midst of it. So it's not like you decided that I got to like the turmoil when that aversion shows up or some difficulty shows up, but your ability to ride through it, very different. Your ability to be with it, your resilience, your ability to come back to the practice, even when everything drops out, that is what's different. That's what gets strengthened when you gradually begin to let go of control. It's not that the world gets chaotic. It's already chaotic. But your internal resilience and strength gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And there's less of that pushing to make things better. The second thing is that we learn to access a level of kindness we didn't know. That Hiri and Otapa actually help us learn to see something about being with difficulty helps us learn how it softens us up. You know, when my son was sick and he started chemo, and then at first, we thought he was just going to die in a couple of months, but then he started chemo and you wouldn't even have known that he had cancer. He rallied. Maybe it's because he was so young that the chemo just completely shifted. And this was the light version of the chemo. And then, so we had 2 years of just hanging out with him and having a great time. And then, he was funny about all of this. Just one little thing I have to share, you know, like I remember going in one day to check on him, and I asked him if he needed anything. And he goes, "No, Mama, this is great." He goes, "I'm like a 35-year-old man laying in the bed playing video games. And nobody comes in and says, get a job." Instead, they come in and say, "Do you need anything? Can I help you?" It's cracking up. But that's the way he was. This kind of very sweet energy. And so at some point, things begin to turn. And he knew that his oncologist says, okay, now we are coming towards the turning point here, and it's going to start going downhill from here. Not flat anymore, downhill. And so he tells me, we need to get the family together, and we have to talk to them about what's about to happen, and that it's going to get more difficult, be more suffering, more problematic. And I said, "Well, why do we need to tell everybody?" And he goes, "Well, because, you know, regular people don't understand suffering like we Buddhists do." I didn't even know he was Buddhist, but apparently we are. And the sweetest thing he said was that Buddhists do suffering like poetry. And you can just think of some of the softest, most painful poems that we have read. And yet there's such a gentle tenderness with it. Because the point of that poem is to have us feel into the suffering, not as something's wrong, but something's real. It's a part of life. And we can feel into poetry some of the saddest poems. I can remember reading Thich Nhat Hanh's poems on boat people. And some of it was so tender. And yet, It was mind-blowingly beautiful, mind-blowing. And so this is this, Hiri and Otapa are creating a way for us to begin to deal with some of this difficulty, some of this pain, some of this dukkha and suffering in a softer, kinder, loving way. Not from a place of fighting and pushing against it, but from beginning to understand the habit mind of the kid that started that suffering in the first place, that started that habit in the first place. You begin to understand where some of these habits and difficulties have come from a softer, kinder way. And then lastly, what I think Hiri and Otapa point us towards is how to begin to actually see our harm. It's strange, but I don't think the Buddha was pointing us to the peaceful, blissful states of deep absorption, samadhi, even though that's what we all run after and chase after and all want, and myself included. What I think he was actually pointing us towards is non-harm. Non-harm, that's it. Living in a world that is dominated by harm. It's dominated by causing harm necessarily to someone else, because if I don't cause harm to you, you might cause harm to me. So he is in the midst of a world, and he lived in the same world. It was just as bad when the Buddha was walking around as it is right now. May not seem like it. Might seem like this is the worst it's ever been. I assure you, it has been this way all along. As we're really, I don't know a time in history when we were not oppressing somebody. Somebody was having problems. So there's a way in which Hiri and Otapa sensitize us to the knowing of harm. That's what you're sensitized to. That's what you feel, is that you can tell. If you were to see a worm struggling to get somewhere with fear of all the birds roaming around, you would be so inclined to help that worm hide out in the grass, get it to someplace safe. At a time when the world wouldn't even think about worms, and yet here you think about all kinds of creatures. It's amazing to me how quickly we will snatch up a spider or a tick or an ant or some kind of little insect and take them out. And take them out of this space, not because we don't want them around, but because we know they could be harmed if they stay here. If we don't cover things up, we know they can get harmed. And so instead, there's this overwhelming sense of wanting to care after beings. So here in this place where we're uber sensitive around harm, and we can feel it in the room, everywhere, just so sensitive around it, you take this level of sensitivity and you go out in the world of samsara, where the automatic reactivity is just pushing, not to harm you on purpose, but just to get the control, just to keep myself safe. I got to push on everybody else. Then how do you be in that world and not get tossed about? Hiri and Otapa, they are these bright, shiny things that we begin to know where harm is. How harm is. Less about right, wrong, good, bad, who's this, who's that, pleasing, not pleasing, and more about where is the sense of harm. And when you speak to harm, and you learn to speak from that, speak from harm, just the sense of where the harm is, even your own behaviors, is not to push on, you have to believe me as much as it is, we take these very, very strong stances around harm. And that's it, strong stance around harm. There's a sutta where the Buddha says, he says that effacement, he says, is many people might think it's these great lofty states of meditative states of attainment, but they would be wrong. That is not effacement. So no amount of deep concentration is going to bring you towards effacement. It'll bring you to deep states of concentration, but eventually you're going to have to go out in the world and you're going to have something that you're wrapped in to keep you from harming others. And this effacement, he said, and he lists these 44 vows. But what I like what he says is, he says, others will do this, like the precepts. Others will harm other beings. We will not harm other beings here. He says, others will use false or harmful speech. We will not use harmful or harsh speech here. Others will take what is not freely given. We will not take what is not freely given here. And he goes all the way down this list of precepts and all these other value markers, 44 of them. And I remember getting a sense that this expanded understanding of effacement, what that effacement is actually doing is turning me into a non-harming being. I may live in a world where there's a lot of harm, but I will not add to that harm. That somehow I'm going to move in the world and stand up on behalf of beings being harmed, and I will adjust and correct and do whatever I need to do so that I don't harm any other beings. And I remember when we used to wear that safety pin, I wore that safety pin proudly. I was so disappointed when it was like, you just got a safety pin on there. It doesn't do anything. I thought that was one of the best things ever. But it doesn't actually help anyone because I have a safety pin. I know that. But I somehow want the whole world to know that they do not have to fear me. You can fear others, but you do not have to fear me. And that's what I thought that safety pin was saying. So anyway, I think if we did not have Hiri and Otapa, if we did not have these two boundaries that kind of keep us in this container of Dhamma. And it's not that you are kept in the container of Dhamma by having to have all your Sangha members walk in with you. You don't have to. Because Hiri and Otapa is going to keep this retreat with you wherever you go. This retreat is going to just go with you wherever you go, over and over and over. Because within this kind of system, you will know where you are. You can see where you're going based on this felt sense of tension, dukkha, unease, this felt sense of discomfort is actually your bell that's saying, wait a minute. So I'm hoping this talk answered these questions. For the person that asked, can you tell me what purification is? That's what it is. It's this feeling into that harm and learning to feel it and learning to be with it, be tender with it, be soft and kind with it, and let this wisdom come from what you're seeing. It says, can you explain what it means to be an heir of one's karma? Whose karma am I inheriting? And who inherits my karma? You do. It's all your karma. What you do, the inheriting is what you do, good or bad, whether you cause harm or not, whether you think it's intended or not, that actions that you do out of habit or out of clear seeing, that is the karma, the results, the impact of that. We all inherit that. How do you decide when to ask a practice question versus trust that I know all I need for now? That's how you know. Hiri Otapa. It begins to help you sense into, it's almost like turning a light on. So the last one, can you talk about working with practicing with entrenched habitual thought patterns? This is, all of our habits have to be held within this container of Hiri and Otapa. We have to learn to see it, not me, not mine, not what I am, but this sense of there is some pain here, some tension, some discomfort. What is that? What am I seeing here? What am I feeling into? And let it be a guide to help us see. I spent my whole life trying to not feel any kind of pain or discomfort. And I got to tell you, I am grateful to God Almighty that I feel pain and discomfort all the time, all the time. Not because I like the pain and discomfort, but that's how I know when I'm too far over here, when I'm too far over here, I can feel it on the inside. It's a very sensitive, and we can sense it. So this is what I think Hiri and Otapa point us towards. So I want to leave you with a poem that I think is Hiri and Otapa. It's one of my favorite poems, so you may have heard it many times. But when I thought about doing this talk, I thought, yeah, this is what Hiri and Otapa is. It's called Under Ideal Conditions by Al Zolinas. And he says, say in the flattest part of North Dakota. So if you're not from the States, North Dakota, very flat. One of the flattest states in the whole union. So in the flattest part of North Dakota, on a starless, moonless night, no breath of wind, a person could light a candle, then walk away. Every now and then, they could turn and see the candle burning. 17 miles later, provided conditions remained ideal, they could still see the flame. Somewhere between the 17th and the 18th mile, they would lose the light. If they were walking backwards, they would know the exact moment when they lost the flame. They could step forward and find it again, back and forth, dark to light, light to dark. What's the place where the light disappears, where the light reappears? Don't tell me about photons and eyeball reflections and refractions. Don't tell me about 186,000 miles per second and the theory of relativity. All I know is that place where the light appears and disappears. That's the place where we live. And Hiri and Otapa are on those two sides. That's how we know where we're at. So let's sit a moment here. always hear the bell of Hiri and Otapa. Thank you so much for your kind attention. We have some time for walking, and then we'll come back for chanting.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.